Welcome back to The Past, The Promise, The Presidency. I'm Brian Franklin, and as always, on this season of Conversations, I'm joined by my co-hosts and SMU undergraduate students extraordinaire, Tyler McCall and Tamal Pilla. This week, we're having a conversation about one of those topics that you've probably heard about, but probably haven't thought about in quite the way our guest historian is going to share with us. That topic is Japanese-American incarceration during World War II. You might have heard it called Japanese-American internment. And that guest historian is Dr. Stephanie Hinerschitz, senior historian at the Institute for the Study of War and Democracy at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans, and author of three books on civil rights, labor, and religion in the 20th century, especially among Asian Americans. These topics come together in her most recent book and the topic of our conversation today, Japanese American Incarceration, The Camps and Coerced Labor During World War II. I'll turn it over now to Tyler McCall for this week's conversation.
Hello, my name is Tyler McCall with the Center for Presidential History at SMU. Today I'm joined by Dr. Stephanie Hinerschitz with the National World War II Museum. Dr. Hinerschitz, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
My first question for you, how would you characterize the power of vocabulary in the discussion of the treatment of Japanese Americans following the bombing of Pearl Harbor?
The use of vocabulary, especially by the government, was a very powerful tool that administrators were able to use to convince most Americans that what happened to Japanese Americans after Pearl Harbor, so especially Executive Order 9066, the removal of Japanese Americans from the West Coast and then placing them in camps, prison camps throughout the country, that language was used to soften the blow a little bit and to try and help Americans to understand that, one, this wasn't really violating any of the Japanese American citizens' civil rights or constitutional rights, and two, it was temporary and in their best interest. So one interesting thing is that the government actually tried very hard to not use the word citizen when talking about Japanese American citizens who were removed from the West Coast. They wanted to separate use of that term from the program to make sure that Americans didn't associate barbed wire and camps with this happening to people who were born here and had constitutional rights. And then other forms of language and terms that were used, like relocation centers instead of concentration camps, which is how that was a term that was used amongst officials and in the administration internally. But instead of using that and bringing to mind connotations of what was going on in Europe at the time, instead the government chose to use relocation centers, evacuees, instead of people who have been forcibly removed from their homes. All of this language was used as a way to encourage Americans to not think that what was going on was some kind of violation of very basic constitutional principles. So language, vocabulary was a really powerful tool that the government used, and that kind of seeped into American language more generally, immediately after Pearl Harbor, and especially following Executive Order 9066.
That leads into my next question perfectly, which is, in your research, have you come across any other comparable world events or time periods where the terminology and lexicon used was so crucial in controlling the public narrative?
One example that I can think of in my own research, and as an American historian, I really focus on the 20th century. So there could be a lot of other examples out there, especially historians who study other regions of the world or other countries. But one of the things that immediately comes to mind for me is actually World War I. And so here, perhaps not so much language that the government used to try and influence American public opinion on the war and drum up anti-German feelings, but rather some of the cultural and the social changes that happened kind of like at the grassroots level. So thinking of things like not calling sauerkraut sauerkraut, but calling it liberty cabbage, doing away with names of German streets in the United States and switching them to more Anglo-sounding names. My own name, Hinerschitz, didn't always sound like this, and it wasn't always spelled like this. So it was actually Hinterscheid, which was very German and sort of my family decided to try and make it sound less German and actually more Jewish. So they were trying to avoid that affiliation that my family name had with German. So that wasn't necessarily government policy, but it's the same idea, using lexicon and vocabulary to try and shape public opinion and create a very clear distinction between this is something that is American, this is something that is not, that's our enemy. This is the type of culture that we should be opposed to. And I think that does carry over when we're thinking about the Japanese and Japanese Americans during World War II.
Absolutely. In your book, you talk about free, coerced, forced labor. What is the primary factor you would use to distinguish between these three different terms?
It can be a little bit tricky to separate them out. And I think that is something that my book touches on, is just how interconnected these three different forms of labor can actually be. If we're looking at this from a very American standpoint and how we sort of define these different categories of labor here in the United States, I would say free labor really focuses on a contract. So is there a contract signed? Is there an agreement voluntarily entered into by both parties? So employer and an employee, there's an understanding that this is an agreement. This is how this worker will be treated. This is the set wage. In a perfect world, both parties would enter that agreement voluntarily. A contract would be signed, and then individual rights amongst both would be protected. So the other part of what makes free labor is that there are rights that an employee has, and they might be curtailed, they might be limited, but there is an agreement that this individual can leave that job whenever they want. They're not tied to it. And that if there are certain conditions that are not being met because of that contract, they have avenues that they can use to push back. When you get into the category of coerced labor, I would say that gets a little bit trickier, because then you're thinking about what were the conditions that resulted in an employee entering into a labor agreement. Was it entirely voluntary? Did someone see a job ad, decide, I would like to willingly go into that and work for this set of wages under these conditions? Or were there maybe other external pressures, whether they were applied by the employer, by the government? In the case of Japanese Americans who were incarcerated, many of the administrators said, you don't have to work. You can sign a contract. You are an American citizen. But all the conditions that were working, they were in camps. They were forcibly removed from their homes. If they wanted to obtain certain extra goods, so medicine or other foods that they couldn't get in the mess halls, they would be required to purchase those from the camp store. So in order to get that money, to get those goods, they would have to work. I would say, to me, that's coerced labor, that there are some conditions that are creating this atmosphere that doesn't make it entirely voluntary for an employee to enter into a working or an agreement with an employer. And then the level of what level of rights do they have if any of those agreements are violated? And then at the far end of the spectrum, forced labor, this is heavy state power. This is someone who is completely being held against their will, being forced, given no other options. You will do this. Your life depends on it. Your sort of very basic survival depends on you being able to do this particular task. There's absolutely no contract. There's no agreement. So I think coerced labor gets a little bit tricky, and that's something that I'm really interested in my book. But that, to me, is the distinction between all the three categories: contract, voluntary relationship, willingly entering into that agreement with an employer.
In your book, you also mention how some Japanese American women discovered the unexpected outcome of having more professional opportunities within the prison labor camps and after getting out. Are there any other surprising outcomes that resulted from this period of time that you came across in your research?
Yes, and it is actually tied to this idea of Japanese American women, especially younger women, who are able to break out of some of those paternalistic binds that they had to deal with when they lived beyond the camps with their own family issues. So the same thing carries over to a lot of other Japanese Americans. And there have been other scholars, especially economists, who have studied this. So not necessarily historians, but social scientists who are very interested in what were the long-term consequences of Japanese American incarceration on wages and earning ability, purchasing power. And I've really become interested in that literature, because what a lot of social scientists have found is that because there were in some ways more opportunities within the camps for Japanese Americans to have white collar job opportunities, nurses, teachers, doctors, journalists. Some of those opportunities would not necessarily have existed beyond the camps if they would have to compete with white hopefuls or candidates for jobs. There was an opportunity that was opened, and they were able to get some earning power that they may not have had before they entered the camps. It does get a little bit tricky, though, because it's kind of this artificial environment. So when they're released from the camps, they go settle east, you know, towards the East Coast or in the Midwest. They do have perhaps more earning power, more opportunities than they had before. But many of these Japanese Americans who did or were forced to go into the camps, they had to leave behind successful businesses, careers, all kinds of other opportunities. So to me, I think it was surprising and complicated and really tricky to talk about what opportunities came out of this time period for Japanese Americans. But it is something we have to talk about. And I think it makes this whole context of prison labor a little bit more nuanced.
What is the most important lesson that we can take away from the experience of Japanese American labor camps in regards to our prison labor system today?
I would like to start by saying that because so many historians today prefer to use the term incarceration instead of internment to talk about this time period, there's a very specific legal connotation to internment that's really tied to war, but especially to people who aren't American citizens. So because we're kind of moving away from internment and moving more toward incarceration, and because Japanese Americans were coerced in many ways to do certain types of labor because of the system that they were in, because they were in the camps, then the labor that they did fits on a spectrum of how we might define prison labor in the United States and the history of prison labor. I think the most important lesson that my book can describe or put out there for readers is, one, prison labor might not look like what we think it is. Coerced labor might not look like we think it is. So were Japanese Americans required to wear uniforms as convicts were in prisons? What did the prisons look like? It might not necessarily fit that kind of stereotypical image that we have of this. Along with that, I think we should consider, if we're talking about individuals who are being held in prison systems, prison-like systems, who's profiting from this labor? Who's benefiting? Even if prisoners, and there are prisoners today who do receive really minuscule amounts of pay for the work that they do, even if they do receive pay, who is benefiting more from that relationship? Is it the prisoners? There's an argument that they are being rehabilitated, that they're gaining new skills while they're in prison so that when they are released, they'll be able to be reintegrated back into society in a new way. Or is it perhaps the private corporations or private industry who is actually benefiting from this labor more? Is it the state that's benefiting more from this labor? Those are the questions that I think my book can tell us about prison labor. And that is this idea of who is actually benefiting from people who are working, who are being held, and who are being detained. Who's getting the most benefit of that? And I think that's something that, especially today, more people should think about when we're thinking about prison labor and what kind of context or image that takes.
Well, Dr. Hinnerschütz, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of The Past, The Promise, The Presidency. If you want to learn more after this conversation, we encourage you to do three things. Go buy Dr. Hinnerschütz's book, Japanese American Incarceration, The Camps and Coerced Labor During World War II, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Secondly, Dr. Hinnerschütz's program was in partnership with the Dallas Holocaust and Human Rights Museum. The event has passed, but we'd strongly encourage you to check out the work of the museum at www.dhhrm.org. And finally, if you're interested, we have videos of other speakers that you can find on our website at www.smu.edu/cph or on our YouTube channel, CPH at SMU.
The Past, The Promise, The Presidency is a production of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University. Our thanks to SMU's Dedman College of Humanities and Sciences and the Office of the Provost for their support. Thank you to Pro Podcast Solutions and to our CPH team, especially to Mal Pilla and Tyler McCall for producing this episode, whose original theme music was composed by Marshall Engel. For show notes, more information on the expert guests featured in our conversations, and more about all our past seasons, visit pastpromisepresidency.com. We hope you'll join us again next week for our next conversation.